accession number 27185, reel 56.
Major Barras, reel 56.
You're describing the art of flying according to Art Williams and his rather cavalier method of dealing with his crew.
Yes. Well, as I think, I don't know whether I explained, but his crew, as far as I could make out, was a Pole. He only had one crew, he was not the first officer, I suppose you'd call him. He was a Pole who spoke no known language and didn't seem to know what to do in the cockpit anyway, because this is on an occasion, I think I mentioned, his hand was sort of hovering uncertainly over the sort of knobs and buttons on the dashboard. And Art suddenly saw this and leapt across and smacked his hand away and said, "Not that one, you fool." So I didn't give me much confidence. I'd been looking out of the cockpit window there, and I'd noticed, I looked right across, and of course there was the canopy of the rainforest which stretched right across to the horizon. So I mean, if anything had happened to us, we'd have just dived into the jungle and probably never been heard of again. So I retired thoughtfully to my little seat at the back and sat down there in complete silence for a bit. Anyway, after a period, we suddenly we've been flying at a sort of even keel for a bit. The aircraft suddenly tipped down towards the earth, and somebody shouted out, "Put your seatbelts on." So put our seatbelt. And our producer proceeded to descend towards the earth at breathtaking speed, and almost did a crash landing on the what was called an airport, I suppose, at Boa Vista, because Boa Vista was just inside the Brazilian border. Well, it was about 100, 200 miles inside, and the only way you could get to it was by river or by air. No roads, so in the old days you had to get there by river.
What sort of altitude had you been flying at over the forest canopy?
Well, not terribly high. I shouldn't think more than about 10 to 15,000 feet. Because there's wasn't any other air traffic there, so I think we were outside everybody's control. I can't imagine there was any sort of air traffic control sophisticated in any way there.
Were there any other passengers on the aircraft?
Yes, there were some local Indian type people, and I think they were just fatalists. They'd travelled with Art before, and they just sat there with stony faces waiting for the worst, I think.
Were you in uniform?
No, we were in civilian clothes, yeah. I was there with the Governor's Secretary, I think, as I mentioned, and our object in going there was to investigate the possibilities of gun running across the border from Brazil into British Guiana. As far as I can remember, there was no indication that there were, certainly was no visible indication of arms in British Guiana. None had been ever used there. There may have been some stocked away somewhere, which we didn't know about. Anyway, there was a rumour going round that guns were coming across from Brazil, and we were sent over there to investigate. So after we landed, he and I both got out, shaken but not stirred, so to speak, and stood outside on the airport on the grass, and we saw a large collection of locals approaching towards us, and I thought, this is strange, you know, they're coming to meet us like this. But they didn't stop where we were. They walked straight past us to the aircraft, where Art was already out, opened up his cargo area behind, and was getting out all his wares for sale, setting up his stall. Anyway, we waited there for a bit, and eventually the chief of police, Boa Vista, arrived in the car, picked us up, apologising profusely. And when he got out, I mean, he was wearing a jacket which would have made any of the old commissionaires outside an Odeon cinema simply cry with envy. He got all the embellishments you could think of, and a peak cap. He was wearing riding breeches with very shiny brown riding boots. So anyway, we got in with him, and he took us back to the Boa Vista, which was really a small place. It was mostly sort of one-story houses and a big open space there, but the road was very sort of bumpy. And we arrived at his office, We had a meeting, and which was completely... we didn't come to any conclusions at all. It was inconclusive, and we came to the conclusion that if there was any gun running going on anyway, he was taking his cut for allowing it to go on, provided he was paid for it, and it was a nice little earner, so he wasn't going to give it away anyway. I don't think Art would have been involved in it. I think it was against his interest for people to bring arms into British Guiana, because he was established there with a big company.
You'd have had an interest in the stability of British Guiana, wouldn't
you? Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. So I don't think he was involved, if there was any going on.
Who actually conducted the conversation with this policeman?
I think the secretary, he spoke a little bit of Portuguese, which the chief of police was talking in, obviously, being in Brazil. And then we moved into a dining room where we were going to have lunch. And we sat round this round table, was hardly saying anything, a little desperate conversation, as much as this. I think the secretary's Portuguese run out by now. Nothing happened for a bit, and the chief of police was beginning to get fidgety, and then he saw, with a face like thunder, he disappeared through the beaded curtain which separated us from the kitchen. And pandemonium absolutely broke out once he'd gone in there. There was shouting and clattering of pots and pans and things. about a minute or so later, a sort of traumatized waiter came straight through the beaded curtain, holding a tray in front of him with a sort of big silver dome on it, pale-faced with a white jacket, followed by a long, shiny, brown boot through the beaded curtain. It was an absolute pantomime. And that's all I can remember. The only other thing I can remember is that being told afterwards that the chicken we'd had for lunch was, in fact, Amazon snake. So it's a good job nobody mentioned it beforehand.
Did it taste good?
As far as I remember, it was a bit leathery, but I think I thought it was chicken. So that was the end of that little episode.
Did the secretary give an opinion about that when you were discussing it afterwards? Did he give you the idea that he thought the police didn't?
No, we both thought the same thing. I mean, we obviously came to the same. Was any gun running? We weren't at all convinced that there was any gun. I don't know, the odd pistol or rifle or little bits of ammunition may have been stopped by somebody coming across the border, but there was nothing on a scale which would cause any concern, I don't think. It would help the help a rebellion if it ever occurred. So we returned to Georgetown. I don't remember the trip back. I think I probably closed my eyes and hope for the best. Anyway, we did get back safely. And I remember at that time it was very hot and sticky there. I was sleeping. Officers were all sleeping in a sort of dormitory place. And we'd been told to cover up our feet in case, of course, there were vampire bats there and any passing one who thought he'd come in and have a snack. So we covered up our feet to prevent that happening, because they can cause very nasty diseases. And then, of course, everything was quite quiet at that stage with the troops there. And eventually the brigadier left, and I was stayed there for a bit to act as sort of liaison between the CEO of the Royal Welsh, which were still there, and the government and Brig back in Jamaica. Eventually I returned.
What sort of matters required a liaison then when you were...
Well, on local matters more than anything else. I don't think I did very much, actually. But obviously when you've got a unit, an army in a country which is not used to having them there, and they're not used to being there, there are problems which occur on a local basis, so you had to go and iron them out with the government.
What sort of problems?
I can't remember, quite honestly, now. But there were very few. I mean, the CEO of the Royal Welsh was quite capable of looking after himself, I think. I don't think I did very much, and I didn't stay there very long anyway, and I had to return to Jamaica because of the Queen's visit coming up. And also, we weren't far off our firstborn arriving.
Presumably, while you were away, your work in Jamaica was piling up.
It was after a bit, but what I hadn't explained was that the brigadier recognised at some stage, I think when British Guiana blew up, or perhaps just before, he arranged for somebody to come out and help. And he got a guide to go into the AQMG. He got a grade one retired staff officer who'd been a full colonel who came out with his grey hair, which was quite unusual there. Very nice chap, I remember. And I got a major, funny chap actually. I think his name was Horner. He's supposed to have been a guards officer, but he didn't. Well, from the guards officers I knew, he didn't seem to fit in somehow. But he was quite an amusing bloke, and he came out and obviously thought the whole thing was a sort of an opportunity to have a bit of a lark and going out to the West Indies, you know, nothing doing out there. And he arrived and was all jokey, and his favourite thing was to come in and say, "Strange company shun," you know, these little jokes he came out with. And then he referred to me as his commander, because I was much younger than him, and I think underneath he took a little bit of felt it was below his dignity to sort of have this job. Anyway, as time passed, gradually I handed over to work to him, and he gradually began to realise there was work there, and I made sure he was kept busy. And after a bit, his attitude changed a bit, and we became good friends, and he worked quite happily. So he was there, and he was gradually sort of dealing with things, but of course he didn't know the long-term stuff. He could just deal with things which came up. And of course the AQMG was still there when the brigadier was away and taken over. He had lieutenant colonel, so he had a good idea of what was going on. So between them they managed. So very shortly after I got back to Jamaica, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were relieved by the 1st Argyles, who came out in the aircraft carrier HMS Indomitable. Churchill sent them straight out. I remember it was Churchill's wish that they went straight out. As soon as the Royal Welsh went down to British Guiana, they were going to be relieved. So they came out and took over from the Royal Welsh with the proviso that they'd be there for a year and no longer.
Did that involve any work for you, this changeover of resident battalions?
No, they just did it on their own. Well, there may have been. I mean, obviously there must have been something, because we had signals and medical people down there with it was a battalion group, so there were other people down there other than the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. So we may have changed over the personnel or equipment or whatever, but I didn't have to go down there. Nobody from the headquarters went down there. They just I think we sent orders obviously to the Royal Welsh for the takeover and their return. Now they must have flown back, because a ship would have taken some time, so we must have flown them back. So there was quite a bit of work to be done.
A bit of administration to do.
Yes, that's right.
Aircraft arranged and things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So so they went there, I don't know how long they stayed, but I know that British troops had to go back in 1962 to quell riots, and I don't know who it was. Mm. But the elections, after a bit, the elections were changed so that they were on a proportional representation basis. So it made it difficult for Jagan to get back again. And his place was taken by Forbes Burnham, who was a black African. And he was head of the People's National Congress Party. And he got in. And Jagan was sidelined at that stage. And Burnham was... really got to know the tricks of the trade apart from elections, and managed to stay in right through until he died many years later. And then Jagan came back much modified and not so extreme as he was, nothing like extreme as he was originally. He came back for a bit, and then he died, and his wife, apparently, Janet, who was, she was white, took over for a bit, sort of shades of Evita there, wasn't there?
Indeed.
But they got their independence in 1966. But of course there was a long period when it became sort of roped off from the outside world. I don't know whether you remember, there was this awful cult there, American, and they all committed mass suicide.
The Reverend Jim Jones.
Yes, that's right.
And his followers.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And they went through a very dark period in British Guiana, well it became Guiana, a very dark period, and that was under Forbes, what would I call him? Burnham. That's right.
Burnham, yes.
Yeah. And that was whilst he was in charge, and of course he got even worse than Jagan might have been. Still, he died about 4 or 5 years ago, I believe. Jagan did. One thing that I learned about British Guiana, which was interesting, is that we took it over in about the early 1800s, having exchanged Suriname with the Dutch. Now, I didn't know we had Suriname originally, and they had the Guiana, and then we just changed them over. Right. And then I explained, I also want to get back, because our first child was only a couple of weeks away before he was going to appear on the horizon. There's one thing perhaps I didn't explain before. The Brigadier, when I became Paul Barlow, when I went down there originally, I couldn't tell people what I was doing. I couldn't tell anybody. But he had Anne, my wife, in, and myself one evening in his home, and he explained to her what I was doing, which I thought was a very sensible... He was a very humane individual, and very, very...
Do you think that she worried about you going off and doing these clandestine
things? Well, she
things?
Was pregnant, you see,
yes.
And not long to go.
Yes.
I think she took it in her stride, but I think she was glad when I got back.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a good move on his part, because I found it very difficult to tell her what I was doing, although I trusted her. You don't know what to do on these occasions sometimes. Anyway, I had to give up my Paul Barlow passport to Felix. And I remember on the one occasion, he was a great chap. I had a great rapport with him. We used to have a lot of jokes and laughs and things, but he was very good at his job as well. And one day he came into my office and said, "Is half bottle in?" And I said, "We don't have any half bottles here." And you know full well we don't. And he said, "Oh, I call all brigadiers half bottle." It was about now that we moved out of our house in Stony Hill. I think our lease must have come to an end. It was rented by the army, of course. Mrs. Bolt was the landlady, I remember, black Jamaican Mrs. Bolt. She was a bit tough actually when it came to trying to get things done in the house, but never mind, we had quite a good relationship. Anyway, we now moved into a hotel, the Mona Hotel, I remember, near the Mona Dam, which wasn't far from the University of West Indies, just down the road. And of course, the BMH at the maternity, well, the BMH as a whole were closed down at that stage. I don't know why. And Anne had been paying visits to a little cottage, excellent little cottage hospital just outside Kingston for checkups and examinations. And we had a very good civilian gynecologist, English gynecologist. It was about late on the 11th of November, I think it was, that Anne suddenly decided it was time to go.
Remembrance Day.
Yes, that's right. And our bag was already packed, so we shuffled off to the cottage hospital. And I remember I was there most of the night, and I remember standing out on the veranda there in the morning. It was a balmy sort of early morning, and the dawn was coming through. And a sister or nurse came out and said, "You got a boy." So that was Christopher, which was very considerate of him actually being born then, because he gave Anne sufficient time to get over his birth to attend all the Queen's visit celebration parties and things.
Was that the next big event?
That was the next big event, yes. I had thought that she came in January, but I found from various documents and things I have that she came in November. But this, when she, her visit to Jamaica was part of her tour of the first tour of the Commonwealth, when she was away for 5 or 6 months, I think. She'd been to, before she came to us, she'd been to Bermuda and Bahamas. And she was going to fly in from Bahamas to Jamaica, landing in Montego Bay on the north coast. Now, my part in this was, it was really a Jamaican thing. It wasn't a military thing.
It was a governmental thing.
It was a governmental, yes. Mm-hmm. And even more, a real Jamaican thing. So the governor took a back seat, and the chief executive, who was Alexander Bustamente then, this great character, was pushed more to the front. But I was involved with some of the security, and a big parade which we put on for the Queen.
Who actually provided your threat analysis for security? Was this Felix?
Provided?
The threat analysis for your security.
Oh yes, it always came from him.
It came from Felix.
Yes.
Do you remember what he said?
Oh no, I can't. I really can't. Mm. I don't think there was much. It was just a question of common sense. I mean, in those days, though, especially in Jamaica, there was no animosity at all. I mean, we'd been there 300 years, and everybody got used to us, and they got used to the way of life and accepted it. And they had, I mean, in those days, they had quite a lot of freedom for themselves anyway, in the way they governed themselves. So there wasn't much of a threat, really. The parade was the big headache. Well, I won't call it a headache, but it was a problem. Because we had everything we could muster on parade in the way of frontline troops. There was the Royal Welsh, there was Jamaica Battalion from us. And then there came, of course, the flagship came in, the HMS Sheffield, and they provided sailors and Royal Marines. And then we had the Royal Welsh band and drums, the drums from the Jamaica Battalion, and the Jamaica military band. And then, of course, the Royal Marines band. Now, they all had to be welded together. And we decided on a very simple parade, because obviously we couldn't do anything too intricate. We didn't have the opportunity of having the Navy there to do much in the way of rehearsals. So, we could do it with our own people, which we did. But the Navy sort of came in with their ships. There was a frigate as well as the flagship came in. And I think they came in about 3 or 4 days beforehand, so we got them on parade for about a couple of days.
Naval drill is not the same as military, is it?
Well, it isn't, no. But I mean, they all they had to do was to line up and turn right and left and march. There was nothing very complicated about it. But I was ably helped by the RSM of the Jamaica Battalion, who was Coldstream. Guardsman, so he was excellent, and he came out there with his pay stick and got everybody organised. talking of the admiral, I was he was a vice admiral. I can't remember his name, but I remember when I was in the ship when we went down to British Guiana, or when I went up also to Superb when she was in Boston earlier. That they referred to the sailors, the officers always referred to the admiral's father. And I don't know whether that was an old tradition throughout the whole of the Navy or whether it was just these. But at both ships, they referred to him as father. It's rather endearing, isn't it? I don't suppose he's much like a sort of benign father on occasions. Anyway, the parade, what we decided in the end was the parade could form up in line, in double ranks, in line, with obviously the Royal Marines and the Navy on the right, then the Royal Welsh, then the Jamaica Battalion. Band and drums were either behind, I think, or they were behind.
They massed.
Massed, yes. So we had three bands and two lots of drums. It was quite a parade, actually. There must have been about 1,500 on parade, I suppose. quite a lot to organise and get him lick into shape for a presentation before your monarch. Didn't have all that much time. So the parade, the procedure was that we'd line them up. The Queen would arrive, royal salute, present arms, obviously. Inspection, and she got into a Land Rover or some special vehicle which may have come, I can't remember now, when she drove down the ranks, back to the saluting base. Then all the parade had to do was to right turn and in column of route march past, back to where they were before. I suppose they were dressed. And then royal salute, present arms, Her Majesty left. But of course that wasn't all. All the invitations went out from the governor's office. They chose who should attend as spectators. But we had all the problems of car parking, inspection of tickets and getting people to their seats. And I remember the car parks, we had to have about three or four different coloured car parks to various stands.
Who was dealing with all that? Was that the military police?
Military police, but we also had some spare from units to do it. And of course we had the RAC there as well, don't forget. We had a few RAC. And then of course there was the RASC and others, REMI. They're all local troops, of course. They were all local Jamaicans with British officers. But a lot of those were available for helping as well. So we managed with plenty of help around. So that was our main thing. The other thing the other occasion I remember was the reception which was held in King's House. That was Government House. It was called King's House there. Where it was an evening affair. We put on our mess jackets. Well, I put on my mess jacket, and my wife didn't have one. We put a frock on. And there was a large collection of local people there as well. It was quite a big affair. All the local dignitaries came, and there were black Jamaicans who had the accolade and was Sir this and Lady that. I remember there was a Lady Barker and Sir somebody Barker, and they were black Jamaicans. And the first thing, we all sat in our tables, I remember, and then the Queen and Prince Philip were standing near the other side, near the entrance, as they came in, being presented, where they all ducked their heads or bowed or curtsied and went back, and then they all went to their tables. And then we had a jolly evening. I think we got food as well, I think. The last thing, of course, I remember, but she did a tour of Jamaica. I know one thing I haven't described was her arrival, which was rather remains in my memory. She arrived in Montego Bay, but before she arrived, Bustamante arrived in a local plane on the airfield there and got out, and of course all his followers all went rushing forward to greet him. And then there was one banner which was being carried by two people high up in the air with "God bless Mrs. Longbridge" on it. And Mrs. Longbridge, to put it politely, was Bustamante's girlfriend. And I thought, they didn't think anything of it, but I thought it was hilarious. And of course, Bustamante was a very large figure. He was Irish, Cuban, and a little bit of African descent in him. He was nowhere black at all. He was slightly coloured. He was a well proportioned large man. He was 70 now, and he had a craggy face and sort of he was a growler, but he was never a biter, and he was very popular with everybody, with the British and the Jamaicans. And he had this he was head of the Jamaican Labour Party. And now and again, down in Jamaica, he used to hold parades of his, so-called parades of his followers. And he'd stand up on a balcony in a shirt and a pair of baggy trousers with a shirt undone in front with a glass of champagne in his hand, whilst his mob all sort of wandered past, all waving to him, and he waved down at them. But today,